My name is Liz Harmon and I'm the Vice Chancellor of Victoria University, and I have to say it's a great pleasure to be here because I'm sure that my appetite for tonight's discussion is just as big as yours is. I was intrigued by the fact that tonight, in the briefing notes for the seminar, and I'm going to quote here, the description was that the federal government says that it wants to lift total student participation, open up access to all institutions, improve quality, regulate standards more closely, and create a coherent single tertiary education system. But much remains to be worked out. And that's why I think the appetite of everybody here, including mine, is so great. We obviously are at Victoria University, along with everybody else, incredibly interested in all aspects of the cross-sectoral implications of a push for greater participation and greater equity combined with a rise in quality standards. At VU, we've got something like 50,000 students, and we teach at the school level as well as further vocational, undergraduate and postgraduate level. And we're one of those Australian universities which already has more than 20% of our enrolment from low SES postcodes. In our case, our student group population is complicated by the fact that one out of two of our students speaks a language other than English at home, and that includes higher education students. I had a debate, a correction to make with the state minister once, where she said, oh, that's just your vocational students. And I said, no, minister, it's not. It's our higher education students as well, undergraduate and postgraduate. We're not funded for the additional challenges on top of literacy, numeracy, and a lack of education capital at home that exists among our low SES students for the language issues that face those one out of two students. So for VU, the current debate is a really, really important one, as it is for everybody. We are simultaneously pursuing the whole issue of rising standards and a pursuit of higher quality across all of our education, research, and management activities. And in the case of education, our ENTR scores have been rising post 2000. What is our contribution going to be to the new policy frameworks and aspirations where we're already at 20%? We're not funded for all the challenges we face. We're trying to improve quality. And we're going to go into a market deregulated system where everybody around us wants to draw some of their students from the Western region, which now has the fastest growing municipality in Australia and has high concentrations of low SES students in some parts of the less gentrified sections of Western Melbourne. Well, what it means is that so far in our thinking at VU, we do absolutely want to hold resolutely to both our pursuit of quality and our long-standing and emotional as well as statutory commitment to equity and access. It means that we want to and are talking about both greater collaboration and greater and more innovation. At the international level, we're working with a university in the States which has succeeded in combining access and excellence. We are working and having discussions at, and I hope to extend them at the state level, where I think all universities in Victoria have to think about the VTAC system and what contribution it might make to the future. Within our particular region and metropolitan area of the west and parts of the north of Melbourne, we've been working with the leadership of Richard James on whether we can't collaborate among a number of universities and potentially Kangan Batman as one of the major TAFE providers. But none of that collaborative effort will, among the institutions, will substitute from the fact that VU itself needs to innovate. So we are now looking hard at the manner in which we can make a greater reach into communities that we serve, and we've determined that having a campus in every backyard is not enough. We are therefore withdrawing from some of our smaller campuses, and the federal government has approved those load shifts out of Melton and Sunbury. We are reaching deeper into the communities, however, with a proposal around what we call VU Community Gateways, working in partnership with, we hope, the Department of Planning and Community Development and organisations like AIMS, the Australian Migrant Education Service. We're also talking about extending the work we already do with over 100 schools in the vocational area and 60 schools in the region for teacher education and related activities, where we hope to set up something we will call VU Compacts with schools to extend the manner in which the services we offer low SES students for access and success within VU back into the school system, but only in cooperation with the schools and obviously in alignment with any state and federal interventions. So I'm going to turn the questions around to our two speakers tonight, to Richard and to Peter, and to say to them, can I paraphrase for you both, can VU and institutions like us combine our existing commitments to equity and enhance them while simultaneously improving our quality and standards in the system in the new market deregulated environment? We're going to hear first, I think, from Richard, and you wouldn't be here if you didn't know Richard. He is, of course, the director of the Centre for Post-Compulsory Education and Lifelong Learning at the University of Melbourne, but he's also a national and international expert, somebody who advises government, and I have to say, is a Westie. He comes from the west of Melbourne, knows the west of Melbourne, and we're lending him to Melbourne University. Richard.
I'm not sure whether everybody has the briefing notes, but there is an intriguing phrase right at the front on the first page, which I'll just read very quickly. Meeting the targets that we're going to discuss will require a radical rethinking of many of our assumptions, and I want to contribute to that today. So I don't know how radical it is, but we'll see. I've got a subtitle here, Dualism of Institutional Policy. The dualism is between the pursuit of excellence and the pursuit of equity. And I'm going to develop that theme. But first, just to give you an idea of the scope of what I'm going to cover, just in one slide, I'm going to summarise my argument, and then I'll move on to develop the theme. Overview. We're talking about the nexus between schools and universities. The primary relationship is through the curriculum. We have to keep that really firmly in mind. Not selection, curriculum. Selection is important, extremely important, but it's secondary. Because curriculum is the primary link, resource differences between schools become very, very important, and we can't overlook them. The curriculum is resource sensitive, and it's highly discriminating in social terms, as we're going to see. Admissions policies, such as in this university, can compensate to some extent for the effects of resource differences, for example, by reserving places. But even reserved places are subject to selection by score, which is the dominant mechanism, and score takes us back to curriculum, and in the long run, to the resources that sit behind schools. Therefore, if you want to expand low SES access to higher education, you must reform the curriculum through which the relationship is governed. And you must change the funding regime. So that's a summary of my overall point of view. Now let's have a look at the context. This is a rough chart of the share of undergraduate enrolments, which is in Bradley. It's stable for many years, around 15 to 16%. Now their aim is to get it up to 20%, as Liz was indicating, by 2020. So we have to bridge the gap. But how do we bridge the gap if we can't explain why we have the gap? So our first task is to explain the gap. And there's another gap to explain, which we talk less often of, which is why are high SES students so overrepresented in higher education? We have two questions to ask, success and failure, not just one or the other. Bradley helps us a great deal because in her report highlights the stability of the pattern. She then goes on to deal explicitly with the range of demand and supply factors that are inhibiting low SES access to higher ed. Much of her work is based on Richard James's research, and I'm just summarising it here very quickly. To what extent are young people from poorer backgrounds aware of what they could do? What are their hopes and what shapes their hopes? What about their attainment in school? If selection is based on score, this is obviously critically important. And what about the direct and indirect costs? On the supply side, well, how are we selecting for university? To what extent are we active in the schools themselves as distinct from waiting for people to knock on the door? And what about financial support for the institutions, including Victoria University, which have to help and support continuously poorer students? To me, there are two underlying fundamental issues that we need to address as we go forward into this new century. We have to tackle social patterns in educational achievement at school if we wish to raise the platform of participation in university. These underlie low retention, which is simply the most obvious and crude indicator of the impact of achievement. We have to look at institutional policies and behaviours that contribute to these patterns, because the behaviour and policies of universities are not neutral to social patterns in achievement. We have to deal with that. It's not only selection, but more fundamental connections. Let's look quickly at some snapshots of unequal achievement, and why I'm doing this is to highlight what's at stake and the magnitude of the change we're asking for. First of all, let's have a look at mathematical methods. Why is this so important? Because it's a gateway subject to many, many tertiary courses. If you don't have it, even to a little bit, i.e. with a lousy result, but at least if you don't have it, you're not going to go too far. And if we don't get access to this subject improved, lower SES access to higher education will be skewed to courses which don't require preparatory mathematics. Here I've got an indication of a garbage score and the enrolment rate that sits behind it. So the column chart tells us what percentage of children, young people undertaking methods, get a lousy score. And you'll see that as we go down the social scale, this reaches up to nearly one in three young people from the poorest backgrounds. They can expect to get a miserable mark somewhere below 24. Now, this is despite modesty of participation in the subject, which goes unrewarded. The green line chart tells us what proportion of young people from these backgrounds attempted the subject. You can see the poorest students hold back. They don't test their luck on this exam. They're rewarded by failure. Low enrolment, high risk. At the other end of the social scale, high enrolment, low risk. Now, how do we propose to boost low SES participation in higher education when we have this pattern of achievement in a key subject in the school curriculum? Let's look more generally at GAT profiles, GAT General Achievement Test, based upon three subtests. which all students attempting units 3 and 4, or at least one of those units in school, must sit. If you come from a high SES background, you have over 1 in 3 chance of being in the top quintile of GAT. Really good, and a 1 in 10 chance of bombing out. The test itself is quite rigorous. I think I failed most of it in 2005 when I attempted it. I was certainly the last person in Hawthorne Town Hall to leave the room. And I had a distinct queasy feeling that I had let the side down. As we go down the social scale, what we see is a shrinking proportion of kids from poorer backgrounds being in the top 10%, and a mounting proportion of kids bringing up the rear. And again, is that an adequate basis for recruiting more low SES kids into university? I think not. Remembering Liz's comment, we want expansion, but not at the expense of standards. If you don't succeed well, you're less likely to apply for a place in university. And if you do apply for a place, you're more likely to go for vet. So we have this pattern. The lower the enter, the less likely the application, though it's remarkable just how many uncompetitive students do apply for university only to be shown the door, because universities are not set up to deal with a very super range of achievement. VET comes in to compensate for that, but note the pattern, it's second choice. Do we really want a VET pattern like that? How do you expand low SES into higher education when you don't build up the VET sector as well? This is a critical issue around the nexus between sectors. At the moment, we operate TAFE for school leavers through relegation rather than positive appreciation. This is a problem in the total scene. Well, we've looked at the connection between achievement and SES in terms of pattern, but what are the processes behind it? We need to know the processes if we're going to have an impact with our policies. Not enough to know the pattern, we've got to get behind it. Let's start right back in middle primary school, where we see a growing divide between rich and poor. Here I'm reporting mean reading scores in AIM at year 3 and at year 5, and I'm relating them to the statewide mean. And I'll begin with the lowest SES primary school kids. The little line chart shows that children, this time in government schools, as they move from year 3 to year 5, actually fall behind the statewide standard. They go backwards. The statewide standard, I've used the whole of the school system, but I'm highlighting the performance of government school kids, not to knock the schools, but to draw attention to the depth of the problem of unequal achievement. The high SES kids in government schools move ahead. Why the gap? And if we don't understand the gap, how do we propose to fix it? First thing to note is, across the stages of schooling, rising cognitive demand on students. An example is, let's teach algebra, let's teach French. We begin to raise the stakes, but the cultural resources of children from poorer families relative to those rising demands are weak and are easily eroded. The schools that children from poorer families typically attend, not always, have too few cultural as well as financial resources to compensate for the gap between who I am and what school wants. And it's right that school asks for algebra, and it's right that they ask for French. The question is to support children and teachers in responding to those increased demands. Richer schools, by contrast, concentrate resources both of pupils in cultural terms and of money. Failure is cumulative. I've just put on the pattern from year 3 to year 5. We can go right through to year 9 and then look at what happens in VCE. the curriculum that's waiting for these kids who are unequally prepared through compulsory schooling is hierarchical. It's a beautiful, elegant structure. You can study it in my very enjoyable book, Academic Success and Social Power, now out of print due to popular demand. But it's all there. And universities themselves are complicit in this. They require discrimination. They cannot live in a world without distinction. All universities cannot be equal. This is an insufferable cultural affront. So, at critical times, they intervene to assert their authority over the process. So, the arrangements should not be greatly changed from decade to decade. You will remember the kerfuffle we had in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when the universities, quote-unquote, moved on the VCE, laying down their own demands in a context very political. And our Vice-Chancellor here took a big role in that because he was deeply concerned about the possibility of declining standards. I won't read all the text. I've got 50 seconds for every slide. So at critical turning points, the universities put their feet down. But how does the relationship work in non-critical periods, in the routine year after year, calmness and stability and predictability? Because that's the nexus that we have to address. There are a whole series of quite obvious ways in which universities, quite legitimately from their point of view, influence what happens. They set prerequisites, they lay down standards, it's their job. I'm not objecting to it. They have a division of labour in which they decide how much mathematics will be taught in schools and how much they will teach themselves. No one gets to sit in arbitration of that. The universities make the decision. That is a critical issue in a power relationship. For example, from memory, the whole of mathematical methods is prescribed. Concentrate content, because you need to discriminate and you need to make provision to identify the brighter student. So you need to pack the content in. You need intense and balanced assessment, a driven pace of learning, pressure on schools to narrow their instructional regime to respond to the impossible timelines, selective admissions based on score. Traditional teaching practice in university, which is a key issue. Our teaching methods, you're sitting in a lecture theatre which takes 500 students. It is not designed to pick up where schools have failed. Prestige student recruitment, the famous bus that left from Parkville to go to Queensland. This has an effect. People self-select. From a school's point of view, especially schools from which the growth in higher education that we expect to come, the environment is one of unrelenting pressure. Here are some quotes from VCE coordinators in the western suburbs. It would be good to be allowed to teach according to the Victorian essential learning standards and the principles of learning and teaching. It would be good. We need to get rid of the archaic learning style of VCE. It's very brave, this, with its teacher-dominated delivery. I consider VCE to be an outdated, archaic system which caters for one learning style only. VCE is very content-oriented and the pace is inflexible, goes against everything we know about learning. Now, these are the views of senior teachers in the schools from which we hope to draw an increasing proportion of children from low SES backgrounds. 60% of VCE coordinators in the western suburbs in government schools complain that the pace of learning is a general problem, not an individual problem, a general problem. The universities themselves are acute about this. they could be accused by some, including me, of investing in social inequality by playing the prestige game. It sounds crude and easy to sling off at universities, but it's a very serious issue. They have a big stake in curriculum as a sorting device. They need distinction. They should be seeking it in terms of research, knowledge transfer, quality of teaching within the organisation, but they thrive on external distinction linked to who you get. It's perfectly legitimate to push for better preparation, but it's another question if what you want is to be distinguished on a league ladder. That is an institutional benefit of a different character. We in this university are frequently told that we have the best students in the best of possible worlds. There's competition from Monash, of course, but then it all becomes rather vague. We really are miles ahead. That actually sends a signal out. It says, who will go to the University of Melbourne? Only the best. And we have rules, 90 intake, 95 intake if you're not from an underrepresented school, etc. The search for distinction produces these perverse effects. Parents get the message, they're not idiots. They combine together in selective schools to fight back and get the maximum competitive advantage. Within schools, we've seen the pressure, the intense pressure it places, both at high-end schools and low-end schools. This is antithetical to the philosophy that many teachers would prefer to pursue. They want depth of learning, they want experience and meaning in the instructional process. They want real contributions from students, not merely formal contributions. But they're dominated by an antique system of exams, relieved only by an intense process of internal assessment, which anybody, including me, who has recently sat the literature exam, knows how grueling it is. It's very antique, I agree with that bit. The curriculum creates bridges between the universities and selective schools in particular. These schools operate as powerful bureaucracies. They are very good. They're very bureaucratic. They're very effective. And you can understand perfectly well why they should operate in the way they do. They're paid to do it. They're paid to eliminate failure and maximise success. Why should we complain? The best universities get the best students. The best schools tend to monopolise the best universities. Who is in control of the game? Who is the slave to whom? Have universities been colonised? It's embarrassing to think they might. Let's have a look at the evidence. I'm going back to 2005 and I'm looking at the share held by schools of the offers that led to enrolment in undergraduate programs in my university here. It's not particularly scandalous because it's old and out of date, but I'll update it shortly. So the right hand, the vertical column tells us what percent of undergraduate offers that led to enrolment were held by a school, and the horizontal axis is the mean socioeconomic status of the student. It's based on postcode, which is a bit vulgar. So the red is the government high school system. Notice a couple of schools right out there in front. We all know who they are. According to letters and opinion pieces in the newspaper, they are champions of working class progress. I kid you not, these are the words. Were it not for us, the working class would be much further behind. Behind what? We have Catholic schools there and we have private non-Catholic schools. What's striking about this pattern is a concentration of offers in relatively few schools. In fact, 57% of places gained by 57 schools, 15% of all schools. 41 of the 57 are non-government schools. I describe this as a symbiotic relationship where it's doubtful that we know who is in charge. Is it apocryphal that several years ago the principal of a leading independent school came up to a vice chancellor at this university and reproached him for the declining share of medical places that his school could boast? I'm not sure whether this is true or not, but the school that he came from once claimed 7% of all intakes to the medical school, and the sister school another 7. Not bad. Things have definitely improved under the Melbourne model, but much more remains to be done. Now let me compare that with Victoria University, with all due respects to Liz. The red line, which should be on 1,000 but isn't, is telling us where the average SES is. So we get a fairly normal distribution, at least as the eye sees it, but not a lot of concentration, nothing really much above 1.5. So it's a spread out effort, there's exposure to a lot of schools. VU at the point of enrolment is still more selective than it is in terms of applications, but it's not so striking as this pattern. In case you feel that that is long gone and in the past, the bad old world, let's have a look at some more recent data. I'll go quickly. This is 2007. If anything, our working class champions have increased their share. They really know what the business is and they get on with it and they're quite successful at it, and that's fine. But to me, the issue is if you cling on to that relationship, then don't expect to have too many more low SES kids coming to the door. And how do you cling on to that relationship? By maintaining the curriculum as fundamentally a device of discrimination. I say that the fight for equity has been lost to the fight for excellence. We'll come back to what's being done to restore that, but let's look at it. The universities shape and maintain a hierarchical curriculum. No one denies their right to do it. That promotes selective schooling. That leads to unequal concentration of financial and cultural resources, which our funding policy nationally reinforces. That leads to inequities in achievement and participation, which in turn narrows social intakes to university and leads to institutional distinction, which is precisely the thing required by the institution, or by some of them that can go for it. That is Mr. Hyde, who gets what he wants. And here is Dr. Jekyll, who objects to the scandal of inequity and demands a more balanced outcome. Well, how are we to create a more inclusive relationship? We are already at work doing that. The university that we're standing in is very vigorous, and if you doubt it, read the Refining Our Strategy document. And Liz leads a university which is very innovative in this respect. So let's note the types of outreach we have. Well, we're aiming to reduce cultural and financial barriers, and we have a range of measures there. We're going for aspirations, we're going for knowledge, reduce the cost of study through scholarships and cost of living. In other institutions, let's improve the competitiveness of the working class. We'll do that. How will we do that? Train them for exams. I'm going to give examples of it. Supplementary classes, pre-select the candidates, remove constraints of institutional provision. Remember the supply side factors that Denise Bradley highlights. Well, vary the admission requirements, reserve places. we're active in trying to get equity on the agenda, and I don't want to suggest complacency in that respect, but is it adequate given the changing policy goals? This is my university. Access Melbourne, 20% of undergraduate places reserved for people with ongoing disadvantage during schooling. There's 9 categories, I'm not going to go through them. It's a significant effort. But as our Vice-Chancellor points out, it's marred by problems of selection within that. The Kwong Li Dao Scholars Programs, really important. The threshold of admission lowered from 95, not to 50, but to 90. It's still better than nothing. But it's limited and it doesn't sacrifice standards. Scholarships for merit and scholarships for equity. These are important initiatives and they're not purely cosmetic. They cost money, they cost effort, they have to be resourced, they're very important, but are they adequate? Let's take a trip overseas to another elite institution and see what it's trying to do, because the problem is international, not purely national. Yes, I'll go fast. This is the Institut d'Etudes Politiques in Paris, and it's got an exciting priority access scheme, and I won't give you all the details because I don't have time to do it. And its poor neighbour in the north of France is also into the game of rediscovering reputability in social access. It's trying as well, and I'm going to come to Victoria University shortly. But all these programs suffer from significant limitations. They don't change the nature of the demands we make on students. We assume that they're problematic, and here I'm not talking about the demands formalised in a study design, but the demands emerging from the taught and assessed curriculum, what sort of behaviours you must evince to be successful, because they're not the same things. The curriculum remains a vehicle of selection. Competitive performance is valued over depth and breadth of learning, though the depth and breadth of learning is fundamental to the VCE vision. Resource concentration continues. Regardless of the extent of outreach, the basic framework is unaffected. At best, what we used to call the meritorious poor are made more competitive. The great majority of low SES students are ignored. Could we do more? These are the 3 points I mentioned earlier. What more could we do? We could change selection. We could reform the curriculum. There's no point changing selection if the primary vehicle of the relationship is curriculum, is what we demand. So change selection, why bother if you leave the curriculum unaffected? But to reform the curriculum and not assist poorer students to achieve well under a revised curriculum is also inadequate. So there must be a strong push to boost achievement. And how will you do that if you don't reform the funding regime in Australian schools? Victoria University has recognised this. It doesn't wait. It's going out to work with your school to improve student success. Here's the model. We put effort into learning support programs. We have context-sensitive teacher training. We get back higher student achievement, higher retention and aspirations, higher standard of intake, which improves learning for our students when they are enrolled and reduces attrition. Good model. But it's one university, and it doesn't deal with systemic problems. Systemic problems we've got to tackle. We need to enunciate deeper expectations of learning. We actually have to raise the bar on what we require. Less prescription, more emphasis on growth, much more space for teachers to work. An example is the new GCSE functional skills in mathematics in England. Deliberately makes more space to get more learning. We need universities to promote change in the teaching culture of schools and for change in culture, the teaching culture of universities themselves. I have to rush this, so these are all linked. Change expectations, focus on deeper learning, breadth of view, creativity, synthesis. That's what we want. That implies changes in what universities themselves do. Of course, curriculum reform is not just about sorting out things between universities and schools, but universities have a major role to play. Get rid of the scaling process, which we can argue in our time for discussion, but it's barbaric. It punishes weaker students and rewards stronger students, which is no way to get the maximum effort from all students, which is the purpose of the curriculum. The purpose of the curriculum is to get more work done. You don't get more work done by punishing students through degrading their scores. Require greater breadth and depth of learning through whole student programs instead of the open palette curriculum that we have. Reduce reliance on ranking by major improvements in instructional design and teaching in universities. If you can teach better, you can recruit more widely. You will not rely so much on prediction of success. And we need greater institutional diversification through student-centred funding. I'm getting to the end of this transformation in instructional design, and I've outlined what that would represent. If we improve on those fronts, we reduce our reliance on prediction of success. If we get greater diversity in our institutions, we reduce our reliance on rank. Two key issues. Questions, second last slide. Questions for any university to recruit the best and brightest. Are your policies and behaviour helping to enlarge the pool of talent in the whole school system, not in a tiny part of it, in the whole school system? Do you take responsibility for the whole school system? Are you helping to create the kinds of learning, the kinds of knowledge, the kinds of thinking that the world needs? Or are you content to fight for your share of the best of the existing talent, ignoring the weaknesses in it? And I've concluded here, given marked and persistent social differences in achievement, can we substantially improve equity in higher education without improving quality of learning for all low SES kids, regardless of their aspirations? Thank you.
Everybody, if you are happy with it, I thought that we should go straight on to hear from Peter Dawkins, Secretary of DECD, and then open up to what I know is going to be a very lively conversation. Peter?
Thanks very much, Liz. As Liz says, I'm Secretary of DECD. Just in case you don't know what DECD is, it's the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development here in Victoria, which is actually in the top of that slide. So after that very challenging presentation by Richard Teese, which I think had some very, very good points in it, which will no doubt stimulate some great discussion, I just want to give you a bit of a perspective from the point of view of the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development, I guess, which oversees education and early childhood development in Victoria. So we're responsible for overseeing the development of all young people from birth to 18. And so the sort of the Bradley targets are really about what's going to happen to that cohort of young people in Victoria after they get to the age of 18, when my department ceases to have responsibility for them. I want to put it into a sort of a national and international context as well, and to just think about how Victoria is placed relative to our other states around Australia, and how Australia is placed with respect to the rest of the world in relation to these kind of targets. And then talk about what I think are the challenges in meeting the targets and the sort of strategies that we need to engage in. And there'll be quite a bit of interface with what Richard was talking about. So the Bradley Report, the government's targets, they've been well rehearsed by Richard. I might give you a little bit more detail about that. But also I just want to tell you a bit about Victoria's current performance, how we're going with respect to the percentage of 25 to 34-year-olds who are graduates. So that's about how big the gap is for the overall target. So as well as a low SES target, there's a target for the percentage of all 25 to 34-year-olds who are graduates of our universities. And that's, you know, that's a participation target. It has an interaction with the low SES target, because if you've got to increase the proportion of students coming from low SES backgrounds significantly, and you're increasing the total number at the same time, then the numbers of low SES students have got to increase by even more than you might originally have thought of. So we'll have a look at how Victoria's going with 25 to 34-year-olds who are graduates. Then we'll come back and think about the sort of the source of people who are going to eventually be the graduates, and that's, I think, what Richard was focusing on. Fundamentally, if we're going to get more people being graduates, and particularly more low SES students being graduates, we have to think about how well they go at school, how well they go in achieving Year 12 completion or equivalent. So I'll show you some data about how Victoria's going there. And some of that is quite optimistic, because there are some very good trends. And so I think, you know, the outlook is quite positive. And then a particular focus on students from low SES backgrounds. So a bit of an exploration of the data to get a sense of the scale of the challenges, how it varies across different parts of Victoria, and how we compare with Australia and the rest of the world. And then some discussion of attaining the targets. And if we're going to attain the targets, then we are going to increase, we are going to have to increase Year 12 completions, especially of those from low SES backgrounds, and successful transitions of those students into universities, which relates, I guess, to the pathways that they take from secondary to tertiary education. So that's an overview of what I'm going to be talking about. So there are the targets. So by 2025, at least 40% of 25 to 34-year-olds to have attained a qualification at bachelor level or above. And by 2020, 20% of students enrolled in higher education at undergraduate level are to be from low socioeconomic status backgrounds. So what do we need to do in Victoria to achieve those targets? Well, for the 40% target, we have to get an extra 6 percentage points. So if the 40% target applied to Victoria, let's say, and it's an interesting question, of course, how these targets are going to be distributed. Are they going to be distributed university by university? Are they going to be distributed state by state? And of course, Victoria has, when you get to the low SES there, the 20% for low SES, we have a lower proportion of low SES background students in Victoria. So there's about 22% in Victoria as opposed to 25% nationally. So it's just that there's a slightly lower incidence of lower socioeconomic status in Victoria. So if we have the same target as everyone else, I guess you know that there is that difference to bear in mind. But anyway, imagine we did have a 20% target. That means we've got to go from about 13 to 20, which is a 7 percentage point increase. So you know, 7% on 13 is just over 50%. But then when you bear in mind that we're trying to increase the total number of graduates, that first target, then that actually means the actual increase in the numbers of students is about, of low SES students, is about 75% that will be needed by the date in question, which was, well, the 2020 was the date for low SES, 2025 for the other one. So I guess it's by 2025. We need 75% more low SES students in getting bachelor's degrees in Victoria. So it's a pretty massive increase. And Richard talked a lot about the sort of the challenges there of achieving, you know, a significant increase for our low SES students. So how does Victoria perform internationally? So this 25 to 34-year-old target is 40%. Well, this one here actually is cheating a bit because we've got diplomas and degrees there. It might make it look as if we've already made the 40% target. So the yellow line is Victoria. So if you add diplomas and degrees, we're already over 40% of 25 to 34-year-olds with tertiary qualifications. And that's a rather neat graph, which assumes Victoria was a country and puts us against all the other countries in the OECD. And you can see Australia there in the red. So Victoria is, you know, it's a high achiever, if you like, relative to Australia, and a high achiever, in fact, relative to the rest of the world on the proportion with tertiary qualifications. I mean, what we are actually trying to do, though, through these targets is to get up into the very top tier. So if we achieve these targets, we're going to be up there with Canada and Japan and Korea. So that's really what the Bradley Review is saying we should be trying to do. Now, if you actually look at just degree qualifications, there's the 34% I mentioned earlier for Victoria. So we've got to get 6 percentage points more. And again, you know, we are the highest performer in terms of states. Obviously, the ACT is a bit different and unusual because of its very high SES population. But for all the states, you know, Victoria there has got the highest incidence of 25 to 34-year-olds with tertiary qualifications. And as you can see from the earlier slide, you know, this is high by international standards, but we're really wanting to be right up there in the very, very elite. So that gives you a picture of what we're trying to achieve in the overall target. Now, if we come back to year 12 completion, which is, you know, if we're going to achieve that, then we've got to be doing very well on our year 12 completions. And not just getting the students to complete, but obviously to be well prepared for universities. But this is actually percentage of 20 to 24-year-olds with year 12 or certificate 3, level 3. And again, you know, Victoria is a high performer, not quite as high perhaps as we were with the percentage of graduates in the 25 to 34, but still, you know, we are a high performer relative to the rest of the world, high and high relative to Australia, which is starting to look a bit mediocre here. So I think people generally think that this is an area where Australia does have to improve its game. It does have to do much better on international standards, but Victoria actually is doing pretty well. But again, what the targets really implies that we've got to, through our schools and I guess with our TAFEs as well, get up into that very top tier if we're going to achieve those higher education targets. The good story is that we are actually making significant improvement in Victoria. So this is a measure of the year 12 completion target that that actually Victoria has in its Growing Victoria Together policy that was brought in the BRAC's sort of Brumby government. They established various targets, and this one actually appears in my performance plan with the Premier. So every year I wait nervously for the bit of data to emerge from the ABS. But it is a really very good story, so that, you know, back in 1999, we were around, you know, 82 to 83%. Now we're up around 89%. So it's steadily increased, and we're heading towards this 90% target that Victoria set for 2010. And now, nationally, it's been agreed through the Council of Australian Governments that there's going to be a 90% target for Australia for 2015, is it, or 2013? I've forgotten. 2015, Thanks, George. And because we're a high performer, of course, we've been asked to get to 92.6, I think it is, because if Australia's going to get to 90, Victoria's got to get to 92.6. But you can see, you know, we're heading in a positive direction. So in a sense, you know, things are on the up, and so maybe, you know, these things may be possible. Now, that was for 20 to 24-year-olds, and some of that Year 12 completion includes Certificate 2 in TAFE. This shows you how we're going with our 19-year-olds. So if you're thinking of Year 12 completion more in terms of completing school, then this is closer to that. I mean, some of that will still be Certificate Level 2, but you can see that's on an upward trend as well. So most of the 88% that we get for 20, 24-year-olds is really coming through these 19-year-olds. So most of them have done it by age 19. About 80% have got there by age 19, and this is on an upward trend. The really challenging thing, of course, is the low SES story, and that's what Richard was talking about. And there's just a piece of data about Year 12 or equivalent completion by socioeconomic status. So 81% of high SES, 58% of low SES students successfully complete Year 12 or equivalent. Got another piece of data which, you know, is consistent with the sort of thing Richard was showing you about literacy and numeracy achievement of students from different socioeconomic backgrounds. These observations are actually schools, so this is the average that SFO, student family occupation, measure of SES. So you can see that the relationship between, in this case, literacy achievement and or the average literacy achievement of schools and the average SES of schools, you know, has that strong relationship with higher SES schools doing that much better. And Richard showed you lots of data along those lines. And really, this is the fundamental problem that we're facing in schools. It's the biggest problem, really, that we've got in Australia if we're trying to achieve a world-class school education system. For our high SES students, we are really very much equivalent to world's best practice. So if we go to the next slide, I'll show you some comparisons across the world. This is actually 2001 data, but I think it was quite similar in 2003 and I believe 2006, which shows how Australia, and Victoria is quite close to Australia on this chart here, shows how Australia, if you can hopefully see, I haven't got a pointer, but the red thing there, Australia, on the vertical axis is reading literacy, a measure of reading literacy in the PISA test, which is an OECD test. And so Australia, on average, is a very high performer. You can see Finland is higher, Canada's higher, but Australia there is very high on average achievement in literacy. But the horizontal axis is a measure of equity. So this is how much socioeconomic status actually impacts on reading literacy. And so you can see that Finland, Korea, and Japan particularly Finland and Korea up in that top right-hand corner are high average achievers, but they're also very high on equity, which means it doesn't make a lot of difference what your socioeconomic background is. Whereas in Australia, it hovers around the average. So I think in numeracy, it was slightly above the average, literacy below the average, and it moves around roughly the average, which means we're not desperately bad like Germany. But it does mean if we want to be world-class in our school system, really in this area of low SES students and their achievements in literacy in particular, we are sort of mediocre. And that gives you an idea of why we then get those lower Year 12 completions, which in turn leads to lower participation in universities. This also has a sort of a spatial implication in Victoria. So I've just shown there three of our regions and Victoria on average. So there you can see the Eastern Metropolitan region, which is largely, has got a high SES composition. It's got very high Year 12 equivalent completion and the Western Metro, the region that's particularly relevant to Victoria University, relatively low by comparison. Gippsland also relatively low SES composition, has a relatively low Year 12 completion rate. So in terms of the pathways from secondary to tertiary education, this is data from OnTrack, which shows where students who complete VCE or VCAL in our schools, where they go. And this assumes, of course, they've got to Year 12. They've taken VCE, but so first thing is getting them there, of course. And you see, for low SES, we've got a problem getting there. Once they've got there, what happens to them? Well, there you see the difference between low SES students and high SES students in terms of the numbers going to university. And so it's that top group there that, A, we've got to get more into Year 12, and B, we've got to get that blue thing to move out to the right. Having said which, there's quite a few going there into VET Certificate 4, an entry-level VET, and I think we have to be careful to think that by moving the blue thing out to the right, we're going to necessarily contract the VET participation, because really, you know, the VET participation of low SES students is one of the secrets to their long-term success, and it may well be that to get more low SES graduates in universities, a first step may be, you know, more participation in TAFE from low SES, and then get those pathways right through into universities. Again, here's some regional variations of that same data. So you can see that for our low SES students there, we've got, what, about 38% of low SES students going on to university. Well, this is how that 38% breaks down into different regions of Victoria. And I suppose the most striking thing there is that there's a particular problem in regional Victoria. So it's not just that in some regions in Victoria we've got a disproportionate number of low SES students. It is that even within the category of low SES students, in regional Victoria they're not so successful in getting into university as they are in metropolitan Victoria. Having said which, you know, Loddon, Mallee and the Grampians not doing too badly there. And actually, we've got the principal of Bendigo Senior Secondary School here, Dale Pearce, who is responsible, I guess, for quite a lot of those students going from your school into a number of universities, including, of course, La Trobe, and I guess in the Grampians, quite a lot of them going into Ballarat. So that's the situation we're in Victoria. To summarise the story, higher education graduation amongst 25 to 34-year-olds, very high by international standards. Year 12 equivalent or completion is high by international standards and rising. So in fact, you know, in some aggregate sense, setting ambitious targets in higher education, I think the school system and the VET system may be up to it. But the biggest challenge is the one that Richard was talking about. It's the low SES students, and how do we get them to complete Year 12 to achieve what they need to achieve in order to be successful in tertiary education. So, just a few thoughts about that in my last 5 minutes or so. As I say, we've got that's really summarising what the challenge is that I've already pointed out. And for low SES, it's to substantially increase the proportion of low SES students achieving literacy and numeracy standards, completing Year 12 or equivalent, and finding the best pathways for them to proceed to higher education. Now, part of that is about a school improvement agenda, and I think the story there is very positive. That in Victoria we've got a very active and, in fact, world-renowned school improvement agenda that was the latest iteration of which was in the Victorian Blueprint for Education and Early Childhood Development. We've got quite a devolved school system in which school leadership therefore becomes very important, and the quality of our school leadership programs is renowned around the world. And we are also got a number of other strategies there around regenerating education in a number of our areas where school education was, or government school education was tending to become residualised, schools were decaying, teachers were fleeing, teachers didn't want to be there. We're putting a lot of effort into areas, an example being Broadmeadows, to build infrastructure to attract high quality teachers, high quality principals, and regenerate education in some of those disadvantaged areas. We've built a network structure. So although we've got a devolved system, we've now got a network structure of 70 networks around Victoria of 20 schools in each, with experts working with each of the 20 schools to drive school improvement. And so that's part of the good story. And a related aspect to it is we've got a whole lot of strategies which we can talk about in discussion if you're interested in about lifting Year 12 completion rates. We've got a policy unit, George McLean's here today, working between my department and the Department of Industry, Innovation and Regional Development, that's responsible for TAFE and higher education, to work together on lifting the achievement of people in that senior, secondary, post-compulsory range, and you see the data is moving upwards. It is those low SES schools, students, though, that we are most anxious about. But again, there is a good story to tell here in the sense of things that we're doing. And in negotiation with the Commonwealth Government over the last year or two, we have been negotiating through the Council of Australian Governments for a big injection of funding from the Commonwealth into our school improvement agenda, and it has a particular focus around low SES school communities. So you can see there that that there's a substantial investment coming in over the next few years and co-investment from Victoria into low SES school communities around Victoria, around improving leadership and teacher capacity, around improving educational opportunities for the kids, and indeed around community engagement as well, which I think, Richard, one of the points he made is how, you know, expectations of the community and community support for education is extremely important to help drive improvement in low SES areas, and that's part of this agenda. So I think that the funding that the government's putting in to try and drive up the participation of low SES students in universities should be complementary to this funding, and so the sort of partnerships that Liz Harman was talking about between VU and our school system, we are making significant investments in those schools as well, and so that is, I think, you know, an optimistic part of the story. We've also got a national partnership agreement with the Commonwealth Government around youth transitions, youth attainment, and a whole lot of investments going on there as well to further bolster our efforts in raising Year 12 completions. I guess a key aspect for discussion this evening is this issue of school-university partnerships. And, you know, a number of partnerships already exist between, I know there's a lot of universities represented here tonight, and I think just every university in Victoria has got some kind of relationship with schools of one kind or another. Some tend to be at the elite end with select entry schools, for example. Some are with schools in our more disadvantaged areas. I guess in this particular case, it's the latter one that we now have to particularly focus on. And we probably, rather than having a range of things that crop up from time to time for serendipitous reasons, we need to be a bit more systematic and strategic around these partnerships between schools and universities in order to get both the expertise of universities, the supports of universities, help drive up those expectations that Richard talked about. A lot of these kids from some of the more disadvantaged areas don't know what a university is. And there's a whole range of things that we need to work on between schools and universities to achieve these targets, as well as improving, you know, the quality of the education within the schools through our own school improvement agenda. So, increase the diversity of pathways and entry processes. I think the first dot point there, increase entry from TAFE, is a point I made earlier on. When you look at the movement out of Year 12 into a sort of post-school settings, these targets shouldn't make you think automatically that we're going to get them straight into universities in all cases. So I think in order to achieve both the global targets and the low SES targets, there will be increased entry from TAFE, and school TAFE university partnerships are part of the strategy. You'll see Glyn Davis's proposal there of community college on the list is one of the ideas that's been floated to help improve pathways between schools and universities. On the issue of the use of ENDA scores, I think the position that I'd probably take is that for the most part it is a transparent, equitable and efficient system, but we do recognise that the further you move down the distribution of ENDA scores, the poorer it becomes as a predictor of university success, and does need to be complemented by assessments of student capacity, aptitude and aspiration. There are a number of activities already in place in universities along these lines, but something that's well worth exploring further. So in conclusion, I'm concluding really with a list of questions that might help with our discussion. How will the higher education sector need to expand, diversify and increase geographic coverage, including in partnership with TAFE and schools to accommodate the expanded student cohort? How can we increase the capabilities and opportunities for secondary students, especially from those low socioeconomic backgrounds that we've been talking about, to proceed to tertiary education? What dialogue and other processes will be helpful to ensure the school, TAFE and higher education sectors, as well as individual schools, TAFE institutes and universities, work together to plot our future course? And just let me end on an optimistic note. I think Liz set us the challenge. You asked us the question, can we simultaneously drive up quality and equity? I think we can. And I think in Victoria, we're probably better placed than any other state in Australia. The data I showed, I think, shows that Victoria is a sort of an education state. It does have high achievement at all levels of education, but there is no doubt that the Achilles heel is this low SES story. And we are doing some exciting things in schools in the low SES area, but now we're going to have to work very closely with the universities, think about some of the challenging ideas that Richard Teese suggested, and certainly the school system and the Victorian government, I know, is very interested in fostering a very strong dialogue between university and schools around achieving these targets. Thanks very much.
So I'm going to assume that unless you absolutely need to go, we'll spend at least 10 minutes having a good conversation about the ideas put to us. In fact, we could go till 10 past, if you're all happy with that at least. 8:15? One bid for 8:15. Questions, comments from the floor, please. And there's some microphones moving around. I'll pick you up and then just...
Can I just suggest that perhaps we've already guaranteed success in our goals? When I see VCE equated to a Certificate 2 level, and I have a number of VCE students in my school at the Year 11 level who have already completed Certificate 3 and who could not access university with a Certificate 2, it sort of seems to me that it's a very easy formula. You simply increase the number of students doing vetting schools to Certificate 2, problem solved. I think it's an unrealistic comparison to say they are equal.
Look, I think that's right. It just so happens that that nationally and internationally there is this particular measure that is used. It's one that there have been targets set. But actually, I did show on those slides how we're going on Year 12 and Certificate 3, which is also trending upwards and is actually not that... It's surprisingly close to the Year 12 and Certificate 2 achievement levels. And I think as time goes by, we are gradually morphing towards Certificate 3 as the measure we're using, and I think it's actually being introduced now through the COAG process.
Can we had a question or comment somewhere just near a woman. Yeah. And can I ask you just to say your name and where you're from so we can be polite?
I'm Jan Thomas from the Australian Mathematical Sciences Institute.
Thank you.
And before you say, oh, yes, another mathematician, I actually taught in Moreland High School and Debney Park High School. During that time, I got a qualification in teaching English as a second language. And so I then spent a lot of time in child migrant education, where we used to actually really help schools who with low SES, non-English speaking background students. I then went to VUT, where I was in the teacher education faculty. And I think there are some issues that just have not been addressed tonight. One of them, Richard has talked a lot about curriculum, but you can't have a good curriculum, and the role of maths method is absolutely crucial in students being able to access the sorts of courses that have real value in terms of their potential careers and their future life chances. We do not have the teachers, and actions like VUT, along with a whole lot of other universities, University of Southern Queensland, James Cook, Charles Darwin, University of New England, to name just a few, who are no longer offering a major in mathematics or are on the verge of not offering a major in mathematics, are undermining all our efforts in this country to be able to produce the teachers who can give the leadership and go into our low socioeconomic schools and give our kids a chance. I'm a disciple of Melon Olsen, a Scandinavian maths educator who said that after literacy, mathematics was the most important thing in determining children's lifestyles and their chances. I'm a disciple of Bod Moses in the US.
Can I stop you and say,
a civil rights worker who now sees it as a civil rights issue.
Put a comment to one of the, or ask for a comment.
And I want to know, so I'd like to both the chair to comment on why VU is cutting back on its maths provision. I'd like a comment on how you can have a good curriculum without the teachers, and perhaps the Victorian Education representative could also say what's happening in those areas.
Okay, it's a really important issue. First of all, Victoria University, and there's no T now, there hasn't been a T since 2005, Victoria University has made no decisions on the major yet on mathematics. We're doing a major study of all of the small enrolment science and maths-based courses. And obviously, the question you're raising about the interlink with teacher education is a critical one for us. So we will be addressing the issue again as part of a major review that's underway towards the end of this year. The last thing we'll be doing as a university is simply stopping enrolments in such important and national priority disciplines in just the same way as we've had to tackle the issue with languages other than English, where we've come to an arrangement with Melbourne University.
Yeah, look, I have a lot of sympathy with this question. I think that the importance of math specialists in schools is absolutely critical to drive up achievement in numeracy and mathematics. And we're looking at a range of strategies to try and do that. We're actually going to be launching a maths and science strategy later in the year with some of the things that we're doing. But one of the things that we are doing with some of the Commonwealth money being injected into school improvement that I mentioned earlier is employing maths specialists as numeracy coaches around our schools that are in most need of maths improvement, but you know it's a big challenge and it's a very important issue.
We've got another question or comment.
Linda Brown, Swinburne University, Vocational Education and Training. So I suppose there's two white elephants in the room for me. The first one is we're making an assumption that if we get the curriculum right and we get the links right, they will come. I think we've totally missed the debate around the fact that low social economic students want smaller bite-sized chunks of higher education and want to be able to economically get a return on their investment in a shorter period of time, and I don't think we've addressed that. The second thing that's key critical for me globally coming into Australia is a parity between vocational education and academic higher education. And the fact that we don't have a vocational higher education framework. We don't have artisans, we don't have masters for all these people who've done apprenticeships. They've actually got to jump for vocational education across to academic education to hit our targets. I'm just interested in the view of the panel around these two issues.
Richard, would you like to start?
I think I've still got the microphone on. Can you hear me at the back? Just start on the economic motives. The higher the level of achievement, the less they weigh on a student. So if you can get the achievement right up, they'll bypass the economic motive. We can demonstrate it statistically. The higher, the more students achieve in school from low SES backgrounds, the more likely they are to apply and to ignore the economic disincentives, including the risk of debt. So there is a very strong incentive. Working class kids will not just make decisions on, I want immediate payoff. They're influenced by prestige signals. They're influenced by other things that come with rising general level of achievement. So we need to, I agree with partly with you, but we need to moderate that discussion. That conclusion, because academic values saturate the system. People can't escape the culture of it. The second point you make, I think, is equally important and needs to be taken into account is what do we have that's the equivalent of middle-level higher training, for example, in the University Institutes of Technology in France or the advanced technical sections in specialist lycées. Well, we've got the makings of it through our TAFE system. And in middle level, advanced, it's big time. That's a really important area and it's got to grow and it's got to get more respect and more resources in order to offer competition. Precisely those reasons, so long as it's not a bottleneck or the end of the road. And cross-sector, multi-sector institutions have a big role to play because, in fact, it's in those institutions where there are cultural and academic bottlenecks within the institution. So I agree with both points, but the most important thing that I think you need to make is that the working class kids are attracted and galvanised towards higher education the more successful they are at school, and they will put aside economic imperatives depending on how well they're going. So that to me is a really important point of culture in this country.
It's also just an interesting one, Linda, that we're finding, as I'm sure you know, students do not use the economic disincentive to mean that they'll choose a local campus. They will travel. They will pay. It takes a lot out of their income, but they will travel if they're motivated. Mm. Have we got other comments? We've got a comment and question over here, if you could hand the microphone.
Dale Pearce, Principal of Bendigo Senior Secondary College, and thanks for the invitation, the opportunity to be here tonight. My comment is not regarding the one that you've just made, but I'd actually disagree, because I think for rural students, travel is a significant issue, and we can see that in the deferral figures, which yes. Peter had up on the screen a moment ago. I just want to thank Richard for, in particular, for raising the issue about curriculum, because I can assure you that at the school level, that's what we are locked into. It is a game. And we have to play the game, and we have to have our students play the game, because we want to provide the best that we possibly can for them. And if there's something that we'd like to see at the school level coming out of this is some much more flexible modes of identifying students for tertiary selection, but then ultimately that needs to be reflected in curriculum and assessment within the VCE. We don't have that. We don't see an appetite for that. We are a little sceptical about the capacity of universities to do that for reasons other than self-interest.
Dale, thank you for your comment, and I stand corrected. I should have made my comment about travel specific to operating within a metropolitan area where transport opportunities are available, and I certainly didn't mean to apply that to rural and regional. I absolutely accept your point. But we've got a comment right down the back. You could hand the microphone. And we've got another few minutes for any hands that want to raise so I can see where you are.
Howard Nicholas, La Trobe University. I'm worried about the way the conversation is being narrowed to working class and low SES, when we've heard a number of references to issues of rurality and issues of non-English speaking background. And there seems to me there's a real danger that some of our indicators are going to be only in terms of SES and not pick up some of the other subtleties. So we'll end up with the sorts of things that were being hinted at, which is another level of discrimination within this level, where what we'll get selected out is urban English speakers in preference to other people who may or may not be disadvantaged on SES, but could well be disadvantaged on other factors.
Comment from Peter or Richard?
I think those are very, very salient points. In fact, some of the indicators we've used to deal with disadvantage within the university sector have been insensitive precisely on those lines. The rurality issue, thank you, Dale, for pointing that out. That is a critical issue. The charts that that Peter put up show that in country regions, aspirations are systematically lower. And that extends even to areas of semi-rural, outer urban fringe like Mornington Peninsula. We've got high dropout rates, low aspirations, including for middle-level TAFE. Now, that's not purely an SES problem. That's an issue of provision. It's an issue of culture as well. Strong employment emphasis, what happens when the economy turns down. So I certainly agree. The rurality issues are very significant. The economic factor, and I certainly did understate that, is certainly very relevant. The insecurities are much greater. So, yes, those two issues have to be kept firmly in mind in the broader picture.
Can I say, myself, in response to your comments on the coal communities and language, this is one we argued at VU very strongly with the Bradley panel. We obviously didn't convince them, and we've continued to argue with the Commonwealth Government. We do have a piece of research undertaken by the Centre for Strategic Economic Studies with 300,000 data points based on student data at VU from 2003 to 2007. It demonstrates that there is, for some groups, an independent... Yes, there's some relationship between socioeconomic status and languages other than English, but there is an independent effect on success rates of language. And we are still arguing our case, and I'm going to be taking it as the first plank in our compact discussions that we have evidence and we should be supported to give more assistance to students whose learning is being undermined by their inabilities to be better supported on their English language at first generation, second generation, and even some third generation migrants. I'm a passionate one. Come and join me on that one. Any other questions or comments? Perhaps the last one from the centre.
Thanks. Pam Christie from Sydney Institute, TAFE in New South Wales. And I guess I thought I might share another jurisdiction perspective on this issue, because there are some differences in New South Wales not having dual sector universities. And we've been really looking at particularly the interface between TAFE and universities and really trying to understand what is the problem. In TAFE New South Wales, we have 445 articulation arrangements with universities. We don't want any more articulation arrangements. We spend so much time mapping curriculum that, in fact, we think that's almost, you know, the wrong way to go. And the whole debate about competency-based versus knowledge-based learning, I think is a total distraction. What we believe we need to do is really work in partnerships with university to jointly promote dual pathways and take advantage of the applied learning pedagogies in TAFE to really assist low SES with a different style of learning that may be far more appropriate for some learners. But that's not going to work if we just enrol students in TAFE with a promise that they may get articulation somewhere in the future if they've happened to have done the right units and the right modules. It's really got to be a commitment up front from both institutions, we believe, to make that pathway really work. And I do find it interesting that there's so much focus on schools when, and of course that's very important, but I do believe that TAFE has a huge role to play in working with universities and having different kind of relationships with universities in this space.
Thank you. Pam? I think I was fascinated, Peter, by the fact on one of your slides at the very end, you talked about industry-themed pathways, and if you combine that with the point that by socioeconomic group there is a pooling also between different professions, the whole question of which pathways are going to work by industry and by group, we're not even getting into yet. We're still talking in universals and aggregates instead of more specifically. Everybody, can I invite you to thank again our two speakers this evening for their...
Thank you.